Today we're going to finish up our study of Daniel 9. Last time I thought we might get through Daniel 9 last time, but we didn't. We saw that Daniel had been praying after he read in Jeremiah's book that the captivity would be 70 years in duration. They found out, Daniel discovered that apparently at that point for the first time, or else maybe was reminded of it if he had known it before. And so he set himself to pray that God would fulfill this promise of restoration of the Jews from Babylon, where he and they now were, although Babylon had now fallen to the Persians. But Daniel began to pray for the restoration of his people in the first year of Darius, which was apparently the same as the first year of Cyrus. He received a revelation after praying, and this was from the mouth of Gabriel, an angel that he had seen in the previous chapter in a vision he had there, a dream. And the message he received had to do with what we call the 70 weeks. And we read the material last time, and I even made some introductory comments, but to my frustration was not able to go very deep into it. And so we're going to look at that, and we're going to go on and take chapter 10 as well. Chapter 10, by the way, is introductory to the rest of the book. The book only has 12 chapters, and there is no natural break from the beginning of chapter 10 to the end of the book. We have, in the beginning of many of these chapters, a date given. Most of these chapters, in fact. In chapter 7, the first year of Belshazzar. In chapter 8, it begins in the third year of Belshazzar. Chapter 9 begins in the first year of Darius. Chapter 10 in the third year of Darius. We read of no more dates after that because what Daniel had revealed to him in the third year of Darius, beginning in chapter 10, just runs through chapter 11 and 12 also and finishes out the book. So chapter 10 kind of sets the scene for what chapters 11 will disclose. In this session, I hope to finish our discussion of the 70 weeks of Daniel and also take chapter 10, which will be introductory to the rest of the book, which we will take in our final session next time. Let's look again at chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. These are the pivotal verses in understanding many things in prophecy. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city, Gabriel said to Daniel. His people, of course, would be the Jews, and the holy city would be Jerusalem, for which Daniel had been praying. He had been praying for the restoration of the holy city. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street will be built again and the wall even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off. But not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. Now, some of this is understood by evangelicals in a uniform fashion. That is, there are many things that evangelicals do not disagree about on this. Namely, that when we talk about weeks, we're not talking about weeks of days, but rather weeks of years. I pointed out last time, and I'll just make reference to it again, that in Leviticus 25:8, in Leviticus chapter 25, God was telling the Jews that they had to keep a Sabbath year as well as a Sabbath day. Every seventh year they had to let the ground lie fallow and not farm it. And therefore, not only do we have the concept of a series of 7 days being a unit of consideration in the Jewish law, but also a unit of 7 years is considered. Now, the word weeks, as it's translated here, is not a good translation. It's traditional. King James translated that way, and the New King James retained it. But literally, it should say 77s, or units of 7, but it doesn't say 7 what. And virtually all evangelical scholars are undisputed on this matter, that he means periods of 7 years each. So 70 such periods would be 70 times 7 years, or 490 years. Now in Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 18, in Leviticus 26, Moses predicted that if the Jews followed idolatry, they would go into exile and be punished by God for this. But he said that after that, if they continued to sin, he would punish them seven times more for their sins. That's in Leviticus 26:18. That God would punish them seven times more than he had previously punished them. Well, when he did send them into Babylon, it was 70 years. And now, because the Jews, even after the exile, were not completely wholeheartedly in God's camp, as it were, they still had their own areas of rebellion, as it turned out, as we'll see in the post-exilic writings, it is predicted that they will have seven times more than 70. 490 years of further dealings from God, not all of which would be intense suffering, but most of those years, all those years, in fact, they were captive people. They were often in their own land, but they were subject people, subject to rulers like the Greeks and the Syrians and the Romans at different times. So we have this, at the end of the 70 years, an angel appears to Daniel and says there's going to be 70 times 7 more years that God has determined to be dealing with your people to accomplish certain things. And 6 things are mentioned as needing to be accomplished during that time. In verse 24, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, it's probable that we should see these as 3 couplets here, one of these 6 items. Because to finish transgression and make an end of sins sounds almost like the same thing, does it not? I mean, it's like it's in poetry here, and so it's a parallelism. Likewise, to make reconciliation for iniquity and bring in everlasting righteousness, those 2 things seem to be kind of the same concept too. To reconcile for iniquity and to bring in an imputed righteousness that is based upon that reconciliation. Those are sort of the same thing, or 2 aspects of the same thing. Then the latter 2 are probably to be understood as somehow parallel as well. To seal up vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. There is apparently the ultimate in God's purpose was to anoint the most holy. And all the prophets looked forward to this, and therefore sealing up or ratifying or fulfilling the words of prophecies of the Old Testament in the anointing of the Most Holy is apparently the ultimate point at which the 70 weeks looks to. Now, the Most Holy can mean simply the Most Holy One, or it could be the Most Holy Place. In the Hebrew, it's simply the Most Holy, and I believe it's neuter rather than masculine. Therefore, the Most Holy One or Most Holy Place have been debated meanings. If it's the Most Holy One, it would be the Messiah who's mentioned in the next verse. And he was anointed, of course, with the Holy Spirit, according to Peter in Acts chapter 10. He said in the household of Cornelius that Jesus was anointed by God. What about doing good? Jesus was anointed by the Holy Spirit, and this we see at the baptism of Jesus when the Holy Spirit came down upon him in the form of a dove. If it is the Most Holy Place, there is a difference of opinion as to what the actual fulfillment is. There are some who believe there will be a new temple built, and that God has predicted this and prophesied this, and that that new temple must be anointed, just like the original temple was. The Holy of Holies in the new temple will be anointed in the tribulation period or something, or at the end of it. I don't know exactly how they'd apply this. Of course, if we do understand the anointing of the Most Holy at the end of verse 24 to refer to the Most Holy Place, to my mind, it seems most natural to apply it the way the New Testament does. In Hebrews chapter 9 and in Hebrews chapter 10, it speaks of Jesus having ascended into heaven. He went into the Holy of Holies, not the Holy of Holies made with hands, but that which is made without hands, and he has anointed it with his own blood. In any case, it is my contention, and not all agree on this particular contention, that all of the things mentioned here occurred in the career of Jesus of Nazareth. He brought an end to the dominion of sin over mankind. He destroyed the power of sin. Paul says, sin shall no longer have dominion over you. Paul says, as sin once reigned, even now grace reigns in the life of the believer. The reign of sin has come to an end. It doesn't mean that nobody sins anymore. If we did understand this necessarily to mean that no one will sin anymore, then of course this would have to be extended, one would say, at least to the second coming of Christ. And this is pretty much how the dispensationalists understand it. They believe that this prophecy extends to the second coming of Christ. And one way they would defend that is to say, well, listen, certainly there won't be an end of sins until Jesus comes and puts it all down and destroys sin and so forth. However, the dispensational system proves too much, in a sense, for their own good, because the dispensationalists believe that after Jesus comes back, there will be a thousand-year millennium followed by another rebellion. At the end of the thousand years, Satan will be loose for a little while and there will be another rebellion. That would be sin, it seems to me. And therefore, in their view, the second coming of Christ doesn't really bring an end of sins at all. It just postpones sin. It takes an interval of sin, you know, a time with no sin until the end of that time, but then there's more sin. So really, if the dispensationalist wants to take this literally and say, well, the end of sins means no one ever sins after that point, then we'd have to say that 70 weeks must run out at the end of the millennium, and no one I've ever heard of has ever suggested such a thing as that. It is a fact that the end of, in my opinion, the end of the world is when Jesus comes back, and that will be the end of sins, but I don't think that's what this is talking about. I believe this is talking about the end of sin and its rule and power over man because reconciliation has been made and everlasting righteousness has been brought in, which are the third and fourth items on the list. Sin exists in the world and will exist until this world is no more, according to Scripture. But its reign, its era is over when Jesus died for the sins of the whole world. And he brought in everlasting righteousness to those who believe in him and reconciliation. Sin's rule in the life of a believer is over. It's history. And the latter part, sealing up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the Most Holy, I believe that those things can be seen essentially as fulfilled in the ascension of Christ and maybe the immediate aftermath. We'll talk about what the immediate aftermath means in a moment. In any case, there is a difference of opinion as to when the fulfillment of these six items is, and I think that the dispensational view holds that all six of them are still future. And the historic Christian view before dispensationalism came along was that all six of them have been fulfilled in the time of Christ, through Christ. So you've got a radical difference there in those two views on as far as the actual fulfillment of these six items. Now let's go on and we'll see if we can gain any any insight as to which view is more true to text. Verse 25, he's mentioned 70 weeks in verse 24, but now he breaks the 70 weeks down into smaller pieces. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there should be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Now, that is 7 weeks plus 62 weeks. That would, obviously, simple math tells us, that means 69 weeks. From the time of the going forth of a command to restore and build Jerusalem to the time that the Messiah comes will be 69 weeks. Now, some might say, well, why, if he's talking about a period of 69 weeks, why does he break it down into 7 weeks and 62 weeks? That is not at all clear, but the answer may be suggested by the fact that it says at the end of the verse, the street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. It may mean that the 7 weeks, or 49 years, refers to the time it takes to restore Jerusalem after the Jews go back with Zerubbabel and Nehemiah and those guys. That a period of 7 weeks is designated for the restoration of the temple that was destroyed by the Babylonians already. And then the remaining 62 weeks would be from that point until the Messiah comes. In any case, the full time length from the decree until the coming of the Messiah is said to be 69 weeks. Now, if a week means 7 years, then 69 such weeks would be 483 years. Now we've got two numbers to keep in mind here, and this can get confusing, but I'm going to do my best to go slow and keep it from getting any more confusing than necessary. We have two periods of time to consider here. 70 weeks, which is 490 years. And now we've got a period described as 62 and 7 weeks, that's 69 weeks, that's 483 years. Obviously, 483 falls short of 490 by simply 1 week, 7 years. So the difference, of course, between 69 weeks and 70 weeks is just 7 years, since 1 week is 7 years. Everyone follow so far? Okay. Now, it says in verse 26, after the 62 weeks. Now, he's already said there'll be 7 weeks and 62. So, after the 62 really is after how many total? From the beginning. After 69. Do you understand? He said there'll be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. And after the 62 weeks, well, of course, the 62 weeks itself came after 7 weeks. So, you've got after a total of 69 weeks. Anyone lost yet? I want to take this to small bites. After a total of 69 weeks, or after a total of 483 years, it says, the Messiah shall be cut off. Now, cut off is a Hebraism that means killed. So the death of the Messiah is here. His appearance is mentioned in verse 25, and then his death is mentioned, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, what is the city and what is the sanctuary? There can be no doubt. The city is Jerusalem. The sanctuary is the temple that was to be rebuilt. Okay? Now, in this place, we have the death of the Messiah, then immediately following a reference to the destruction of the city and the sanctuary. The destruction of Jerusalem. Now, historically, we know Jesus died around the year 30 A.D., that is the date that most scholars believe was the date of his death. They believe his ministry began in about 26 A.D. and that he was crucified in 30 A.D. Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 A.D., as you know. So we have here 40 years kind of skipped over in this one verse. The Messiah shall be cut off. That's 30 A.D. And then the people of the prince that shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. It skips immediately over those 40 years to the ultimate destruction of Jerusalem. Now, it does not necessarily say that that destruction of Jerusalem will fall within the 70 weeks. Many people have thought that it does say that, but I don't believe it says that. If it does, or if it's taken to mean that, there is still a way of making sense of it and making it true, but we'll look at these various theories in a moment. I'm just trying to take it piece by piece and see what it says. Then we'll try to discover what it means, okay? So, who are the people of the prince who is to come? That's not a hard one, if you know anything about history. Whoever the people of the prince who is to come are, they are the ones who destroyed Jerusalem. Well, who was that? That was the Romans. Who was the prince then? No doubt the leader of the Romans. In that case, it'd be Titus. Now, there is another opinion, and that is the dispensational opinion. According to the dispensational opinion, the prince who is to come is a reference to a future Antichrist. Now, let me clear this up for you. Dispensationalists agree with me in their commentaries. They agree with me that it is here talking about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD by the Romans. I believe every dispensational commentary, as well as every other commentary, agrees with this. This is not a hard one to recognize. After the Messiah is destroyed, or killed, I should say, he was never destroyed. After he was killed, the city is destroyed. That's historical. Everyone knows it happened. Everyone knows that the people who came and did that were the Romans. This is not controversial. But who is the prince? Well, historically, the church has thought, well, the prince is the prince of the people who destroyed the city. That's the Roman leader. That'd be Titus. Or maybe Vespasian, who was the emperor at the time. But dispensationalism introduced a new idea. No, the prince who is to come is a future Antichrist. Now, how does that fit with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD? Well, they say this. The people who destroyed the city and the sanctuary were the Romans. Daniel tells us they are, in fact, the people of the prince who is to come. Therefore, the prince who is to come will be a Roman also. And therefore, many dispensationalists teach that the Antichrist will be a Roman, maybe a Roman Jew, or an Italian Jew. Not all have felt so. Of course, the finger pointed at Mussolini in the Second World War very very profoundly by dispensationalists because, of course, he was Italian, and many thought that his name could be shown to be 666, and that Mussolini was very much thought to be the Antichrist by many Christians during his lifetime. But the point I would make here is that the dispensationalist does something differently than other people do, and that is that they separate the people from the prince by over close to 2,000 years. That the people are the Romans in 70 AD who destroyed the city and the sanctuary. The prince, whose people they are, has not come yet. And this is the way that they understand the passage. Now, it says, "And the end of it shall be with a flood, until the end of the war, desolations are determined." Apparently, the destruction of the city will be with a war, and desolations will be determined until the end of that war. Now, the flood is not to be taken literally, I think, although there were floods of blood running through the streets, rivers of blood running through the streets of Jerusalem, according to Josephus. But in all likelihood, the word flood here is used in the figurative sense that the prophets often used it. An invading army is likened to a flood. In a couple of, lots of different places, but I'll show you just a couple examples so that you'll know that this is I'm not making this up. In Jeremiah 47, this is about the destruction of the Philistines by the Babylonians, when the Babylonians came into the area. It says in verses 1 and 2, Jeremiah 47, 1 and 2, "The word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Philistines before Pharaoh." I'm sorry, it was the Egyptians were the flood. The Egyptians were the invaders here, and that was before Babylon invaded Egypt. "Before Pharaoh attacked Gaza, thus says the Lord, behold, waters rise out of the north, and shall be an overflowing flood. They shall overflow the land and all that is in it, the city and those who dwell within. And the men shall cry, and all the inhabitants of the land shall wail." This is talking about military conquest. And yet the language is, waters rise out of the north, there shall be an overflowing flood. An overflowing flood? This is flood of armies. If you look at Isaiah chapter 8, the Assyrian armies are described the same way. Isaiah chapter 8, verses 7 and 8 says, "Now therefore, behold, the Lord brings over them the waters of the river, strong and mighty. The king of Assyria and all his glory, he will go up over all his channels and go over his banks. He will pass through Judah and overflow and pass over and reach up to the neck. And the stretching out of his wings will fill the breadth of your land." So it's like a flood of an overflowing river coming over Judah, is the Assyrian armies. So the idea of an army invasion being like a flood is a typical prophetic image. And to say that the end of Jerusalem in Daniel 9:26 will be with a flood, I mean, with an overwhelming invasion of Roman armies. And there will be tremendous desolations until that war is over with the defeat of Jerusalem. Now, one thing that's interesting here is that the prophecy begins by predicting the rebuilding of Jerusalem and ends with the destruction of that rebuilt Jerusalem. You see, when Daniel received this revelation, the Jerusalem had been destroyed already by the Babylonians. And so part of what he's told here is that there's going to be an official decree to restore and build Jerusalem. It's going to be restored. The city will be rebuilt, the walls and the street, even in troublesome times. It's going to exist again. But 62 weeks after that, or sometime, some period similar to that, after Messiah is destroyed, we're going to see that rebuilt city of Jerusalem, which was rebuilt after Daniel's time, that city is going to be destroyed too, just like the old one was. And as the Babylonians did it once, there'll be another flood, this time the Romans. And they will come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. So the prophecy basically covers the period from the rebuilding of Jerusalem to its re-destruction, until it's destroyed again. This prophecy covers essentially, the most important thing is, of course, the Messiah coming. But it also seems to include within its range and its consideration the whole career of the rebuilt temple of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel rebuilds the temple and it goes down again in 70 AD, and this prophecy begins and ends with the extreme points of that career, the beginning and end of it. Now, then we have a very obscure verse. Verse 27. "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering." And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, from which the expression the abomination that maketh desolate comes, or the abomination of desolation. Even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Now there's two ways of understanding this. The way I was taught, and the way you were probably taught, and the way that dispensationalists teach uniformly, is that he, in verse 27, is the Antichrist. And that he, the Antichrist, will make a seven-year treaty with Israel. Where does that come from? Well, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. That apparently is the 70th week. We've read about what the first 69. We had not yet, prior to this, read of the 70th. So in the 70th week, it will apparently begin with he making a seven-year covenant with somebody. And the assumption is that this is the Antichrist making a covenant with the nation of Israel in the last days at the beginning of the future tribulation. But in the middle of the week, that is in the middle of the tribulation, according to this view, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, it is not stated how this will be accomplished, but dispensationalists believe that the sacrificial system will be brought to an end in the middle of the tribulation by the Antichrist placing a statue of himself in the Holy of Holies of the rebuilt Jerusalem temple, which they think will yet be rebuilt. It hasn't been built yet. So they think it's going to be built, and then the Antichrist, in the middle of the tribulation, will put a statue of himself in there. Now, where do they get that? Well, a couple of places. One is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that says of the man of sin that he will, it says he will set himself up in the temple of God, claiming that he is God. Well, that's not quite the same thing as an image of himself, but it's close enough to use as a proof text. Although, of course, that does not take into consideration the fact that Paul never used the term temple of God to mean the Jewish temple. He always, when he used it elsewhere, meant the church. But nonetheless, if you need proof texts, you can find them places. And one of them is that 2 Thessalonians 2, talking about the man of sin, says that he will set himself up in the temple of God. And so that is what is thought. So they say, well, that's going to happen in the middle of the tribulation. Paul doesn't say it is, but they say so. In the middle of the tribulation, the Antichrist is going to set himself up, or an image of himself, in the temple in Jerusalem. And that will bring an end to the sacrifice and offerings, just like when Antiochus Epiphanes sacrificed a pig on an altar to Zeus in the temple. That brought an end to the Jewish system also for a while. Now, there's another scripture they think might apply to this, and that's from Revelation 13. And it says in Revelation 13, and this is where they get the idea of an image. In Revelation 13:12, it says, "And he," this is a second beast, there's a first beast in the first 10 verses, then a second beast appears in verse 11. And in verse 12, "this second beast exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the beast," the first beast, "whose wound, deadly wound was healed." And it says in verse 14, "and he deceives those who dwell on the face of the earth." By those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. Then, verse 15, "and he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed." Now, here's the image of the beast. Now, everyone here, I imagine, if you read any popular books on prophecy or heard any popular teaching, have gotten this about the Antichrist. In the middle of the tribulation, he'll set an image of himself in the Holy of Holies of the rebuilt Jewish temple. Now, where does that come from? Is it this passage? This passage doesn't mention a temple. This passage doesn't mention the image of the beast being put in a temple or in a Holy of Holies. This does mention there being an image of the beast, although it does not tell us that this beast is the same person as the man of sin that Paul spoke about in 2 Thessalonians. That's an assumption. It may or may not be, depending on context. Nor certainly does it ever say in Revelation that this beast is the prince of the in Daniel 9, who makes a covenant for a week and then causes the sacrificial system to end in the midst of the week. All we have here is a reference to a beast and an image of a beast, and it's being worshipped. It does not say when this happens. It does not say where this happens. It does not say that the image of the beast is put in the temple. Where does that come from then? It comes from joining this passage with 2 Thessalonians 2. It says the man of sin will set himself up in the temple of God, making himself out that he's God. Now, that's a little different picture, but they figure it's close enough. We can put those two together. We've got an image of the beast in Revelation 13 that has to be worshipped. Then you've got a man of sin setting himself up in the temple as God. Let's just say that means he'll set the image of himself up in the temple. Now, where do you get the tribulation? You get that from Daniel 9, in the middle of the week. He'll cause the sacrifices and offerings to cease. Well, does that say there that it'll be by setting up an image in the temple or by any other such desecration of the temple? No. That's brought in. Why? Because the prince of Daniel 9 is assumed to be the man of sin of 2 Thessalonians and the beast of Revelation 13. Is there good reason to associate all these figures as the same person? Not in my opinion. But you see, what happens here, and the reason that I never even questioned the dispensational view for years, is that what happens first is they tell you what's going to happen. And then they show you the verses in different places that they say support each individual facet of what they say. They've given you the whole picture. And they say, now see, the part about that being in the middle of the tribulation is over here in Daniel. The part about it being in the temple is over here in 2 Thessalonians. The part of it about being an image that has to be worshipped is over in Revelation. And unless you're extremely perceptive, and I'm not, that's why it took me about probably 10 years to analyze and say, wait a minute, it doesn't say that in any of these passages. There is no place in any of these passages, or in all of them combined for that matter, that gives the scenario that is laid out. But once the scenario is presented, you say, okay, I guess these guys ought to know. They're the Bible teachers. They know more than I do. Okay, so here's the scenario. Where do we get the proof of that? Well, there's a little bit over here, and there's a little bit over here, and a little bit over here. And it never occurs to people to ask, are these different passages even talking about the same thing, the same person, or the same time in history? And there's two ways to answer that. One is to say, of course. Why? Because it fits the scenario that my dispensational teachers taught me. They said this would happen, and of course these all have to be about the same person, the same time in history, because it fits the scenario. The other way is to look at the context of each passage and see what each passage teaches, and then decide, well, okay, is the little horn, is the prince, is the man of sin, is the beast, are these all the same person? And frankly, it took me many more years to do that than it should have. And when I finally did, I realized, no, they're not even talking about the same person. These are not scriptures that join naturally together. What you have to do is get the scenario, and John Nelson Darby made it. He created it from scratch. And then take little scriptures here, here, and here, and try to prove each little piece of the scenario, and hope that no one ever questions whether it's legitimate to use all those scriptures to talk about the same thing or not. This is how we got our idea of a future Antichrist putting his image of himself in the temple. Now, if you had asked me, is there not any place in the Bible that speaks of the Antichrist putting an image of himself in the temple in the middle of the tribulation, I'd say there isn't one place. Not one place that even hints at it. Now, what about this? What is going on here in Daniel 9:27? He shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to the sacrifice and offerings. Well, how does he do that? Well, they bring in the next line to support this. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate. They take the abomination of desolation to be the image of the beast set up in the Holy of Holies of the temple. And that is how he brings an end to the sacrifice and offerings, by desecrating the temple with an image of himself. But does Daniel here identify the abomination of desolation as an image of the beast put up in the temple? Does he refer to it as anything in the temple? He doesn't tell us what is the abomination of desolation. He says there will be many abominations, and one of them in particular will make it desolate. Make the temple desolate, apparently. Okay? Now, what I want you to be aware of is what is and what is not stated here. I have not yet tried to tell you what I believe it means, but I'm just saying, realize it may not say everything that you've been told that it says. Look at it for yourself and think for yourself. Yes, Dave?
So which things came from this position, which came from premillennialism?
Dispensationalism created an entirely new view of this passage. They decided that he, in verse 27, is the prince of verse 26.
Okay,
and that is the Antichrist in the future.
Okay, so Antichrist came from dispensationalism.
Yeah, yes, the future individual Antichrist. Yeah, before that, Protestants all believed that the Antichrist, and by the way, I don't agree with what the Protestants all said before that either. I'm just telling you what historically was believed. I have a different view than what some of the Protestants believed about some of these things, but But the Protestants believed until 1830, all Protestants pretty much believed, that the Antichrist was in fact the beast and the man of sin and the little horn of Daniel 7, and that this was a symbol for the papacy. And the papacy is not an individual, but a system of corrupt Christianity that came into the church. And so so until 1830, there was not a Protestant alive, as far as I know. Certainly the Reformers didn't believe it, and it was not the view of the Protestants that there was a future single Antichrist going to rule in the end times. That came with Darby. Prior to that, all Protestants typically believed, and it was called the Protestant view, in fact, that the papacy was the Antichrist and had been around for, and would be around for 1260 years, they believed, because of the 1260 days. Yeah.
Did the alter view on the beast, did that come from the...
Yeah, well, we haven't gotten to that yet. We'll talk more about that in a moment, okay? now, let me just challenge the traditional view here, not even traditional, the new tradition, I guess, that has become popular. It took me years to ask this question, though it should be one of the first questions you ask. When you find in verse 27 the word he, obviously that is a pronoun. And in language, pronouns usually do not appear until a noun that is its antecedent has been used, right? I mean, do you know what an antecedent is?
Uh-huh.
If I said, one of our early staff members here was Phil Mason. He is now in Australia. Well, okay, if I hadn't mentioned anything about early staff member being Phil Mason, if I just came out of the clear blue sky and said, he is now in Australia, you wouldn't know who I'm talking about. You'd say, he is a pronoun. It doesn't tell you who it's talking about. He, therefore, must have an antecedent. The antecedent is the noun, Philip Mason, who he refers to. Okay, that's what an antecedent is when you see a he, she, it. You don't know what you're talking about unless you look earlier to see some noun, some name, something or person that was mentioned earlier, that is, and that thing is the antecedent to the pronoun. You can learn a little English while you're here. Okay. Now, what is the antecedent to he in verse 27? There are two opinions. One is the view that was held throughout church history by Christians. The other is the dispensational view. As I mentioned, the dispensational view thinks that the antecedent to he is the prince who is to come in verse 26. However, arguments have been made against this view by people who hold to a more traditional view, and that is this. The prince that is to come is not a significant player in verse 26. The main person in verse 26 that is under consideration is the Messiah, also in verse 25. The Messiah is the center of interest in verse 25 and 26. The prince who is to come isn't even the subject of the sentence. It's not the prince that shall come who will destroy the city and the sanctuary. It's the people of the prince that shall come. The prince that shall come is just what we call the object of a preposition. He doesn't even hold a prominent place in the sentence. You could even leave it out. You could just say, the people shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. What people? Well, the people of the prince that shall come. The prince that shall come is the object of the preposition of. Now, if you don't know English, you might say, this is going over my head. But the point I'm making is, if Daniel or the angel Gabriel had wished to feature the prince that shall come as a prime player, especially in the next verse 27, he didn't introduce him in a very spectacular way or in a very attention-getting way, especially since the Messiah has been mentioned in the previous two verses very prominently. And for that reason, historically, Christians have believed that he, in verse 27, is the Messiah. Yes, Darrell? I don't know why it isn't capitalized here. I think dispensationalists translated the New King James, but of course there's no capitals in the Hebrew anyway. The text in the original is neither capital. There is no capitalization in the original Hebrew. That is a translator's preference. But it is a good question. Why didn't the translators capitalize it? Notice up in verse 27. Yeah. What do you got? You got New King James? Well, maybe you got a different edition. They have changed it from time to time. 9:27. Then he shall confirm? Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. The point is that he, or I should say, the capitalization of any word in our Bible is irrelevant to its interpretation because it's only the translators who determine what to capitalize and what not to capitalize, and their own theology usually will be reflected. certainly the most prominent theology today is dispensationalism, and sees he, in verse 27, as the prince that shall come. However, Christians have usually, throughout history, believed that he is the Messiah, that the Messiah would confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. And in the middle of the week, that's 3.5 years, he'd bring an end to the sacrificial system. Now, did Jesus bring an end to the sacrificial system? You've studied Hebrews recently enough. I hope you still have some memory of this. Yes, Jesus brought an end to the sacrificial system. When did he do so? When he died and rose again and ascended in heaven. How long was it that he was in ministry before that happened? About 3.5 years? Something like that? About half a week? The view of the church has historically been that Jesus' beginning of his ministry began the 70th week. And in the midst of the week, that is 3.5 years after he began his ministry, he was killed. And that brought an end to the sacrificial system. Now, on this view, you have to see something about the structure of verses 26 and 27. You don't have to accept it, but you'd have to see it to understand the view, okay? If you don't want to accept it, that's up to you. Verse 26 talks about the death of the Messiah. After the 62 weeks, the Messiah should be cut off. It doesn't say how much after the 62 weeks, how much into the 70th week. But after the 62 weeks, the Messiah should be cut off. So there's the death of the Messiah. And then, of course, the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and sanctuary. That's the destruction of Jerusalem. 26, therefore, talks about the death of the Messiah and the later destruction of Jerusalem. I believe that verse 27 goes back and talks about the same two things, only given a different slant on them. He, the Messiah, shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to the sacrifice and offering. That's when he's cut off. In verse 26, he's cut off at that point. In verse 27, it points out that this brings an end to the sacrificial system. Why? Because it's no longer needed. Now, if someone says, but wait, the Jews kept offering sacrifices after that. Jesus didn't bring an end to the sacrificial system. Well, hey, people offer sacrifices, you know, in the jungle, too. I mean, tribal peoples do that. That doesn't mean it's okay. That doesn't mean that it's legitimate. Until Jesus died, the sacrificial system in Israel was legitimate, was God-ordained. It was blessed by God. Prior to that, after that, it was no longer valid. Jews kept doing it until the temple was destroyed, but it didn't count for anything. God brought an end, as far as he was concerned, to the sacrificial system at that point when Jesus died. Yes, Derek? Then? Well, next after what? I mean, it depends. Well, see, then can have two meanings. It can mean after that, or it can mean at that time. If you say then, if I say, I went to high school in Covina, then there was a dress code. Means at that time, not after I was out of high school. Then can mean at that time, at the time I'm speaking of. Or in another context, it can mean after that. I did this and then I did that. The word then can mean either thing, and it's used both ways in English and in the Old Testament as well. It depends. Does it mean at that time? Then he will confirm. Not necessarily. I mean, it could. That would be a way of looking at it. But it could also mean after the 62 weeks. See, verse 26 begins by saying after the 62 weeks. Verse 27 could pick up at the same point, then, at that time. Now, okay, that's a very good thing for us to look at. Is it likely that the 70th week began right after the 69th week? Now, that is another bone of contention between historic Christianity and dispensationalism. Dispensationalism teaches that the 69th week ended when Jesus was here, but the 70th week hasn't come yet. That between the end of the 69th week, when the Messiah...